Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Acquisitions Anonymous. I'm Mills Snell, one of your co-hosts. Have a fun and exciting episode for you today. Joined by co-host Michael Girdley and Bill D'Alessandro. And then we have a special guest today, a good friend of mine, Brent B. Shore. Brent, thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
We have a couple of fun deals to talk about, but before we get into those, Brent, a lot of people I think who listen to our podcast know you and know Permanent Equity or New Adventures and now Permanent Equity. Will you give us just kind of the brief kind of thumbnail sketch of who you are and what Permanent Equity does?
Yeah,
it's never done this before, Brent.
Yeah, the thumbnail definitely gives a different overview than probably reality on the ground. I mean, I was an entrepreneur at a law and MBA. That was in 2007, and then accidentally bought a business after starting a couple businesses, and then bought some more, and then raised outside capital. And we have 11 businesses now in the portfolio. We have operations, I think, in, it's like 20 some states now. And almost 1,000 employees. So it's scaled up a decent amount. So other than that, we're just kind of bumbling and stumbling down the path, trying to learn, trying to be humble, and keep doing more of what we're doing.
It's awesome, man. Well, I'm really glad you're here. I've always enjoyed, Brent and I used to work together, and Brent's got, I don't know what the adage is, you know, like a 30-second mind or a 60-second mind that Buffett and Munger talk about. But Brent's got a really great lens at looking at companies that are for sale and being able to, I've seen it because we've disagreed in the past and I've been like, no, this is going to be good. And Brent's like, I'd be willing to bet you that this specific thing is going to be the problem. And it ends up being the problem. So Brent's got a really good gut when it comes to these things. Before we get into our two deals, Michael, you have a word from one of our sponsors?
Yes. Our first sponsor today is Cloud Bookkeeping. And this Brent is an interesting sponsor because it's actually my neighbor that I met because of this show. He lives three blocks away, but I didn't know him before. So
always be closing, Michael. Always be closing.
Well, he even bought me lunch and he's like, okay, well, I'm mailing you a check to be on a sponsor. So his name's Charlie Perrin. They run a cloud bookkeeping service called Cloud Bookkeeping that he does with all US-based talent. And basically, it's just the idea of you're a small business owner. You need to do your books right. I think Brent and Bill, we've all looked at businesses where the books were just a total disaster. And it costs in terms of the amount of value you can get when you go to sell the company. And so, you know, Cloud Bookkeeping has a staff of bookkeepers all sponsored by or supervised by Charlie and his people. And they're a sponsor today. So if you're in the market for services where you want to get bookkeeping and so off your plate so you can start to focus on your business, Cloud Bookkeeping is one of our sponsors today and definitely one that I can tell you their bookkeeping's great and also their company at lunch is fantastic. So thanks to Cloud Bookkeeping for sponsoring part of the episode today.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate that. And if you're considering selling your business, you should hire Cloud Bookkeeping before you sell your business so it's easier for someone to buy it. So our first deal today is a commercial roofing services contractor with over $13 million in sales and 70 plus employees. They're very proud of that. They put it in the title. They have $13.6 million in revenue, $1.5 million in cash flow, and they're asking $6.6 million for it, which is a 4.4x multiple of cash flow. They service the areas of Western Connecticut, the Lower Hudson Valley, five boroughs of New York City, and Long Island. So can't wait to do roofing in New York City and Long Island. They have 71 employees, of which 11 are office staff and 60 are full-time in the field. They have about $800,000 of equipment. And the reason they're selling is that the owner wants to retire. So they say they do commercial roofing and sheet metal company, which has considerable repeat business with general contractors, construction managers, and owners. They've got a diverse client base that includes national retail, hospitals, pharmaceuticals, military, universities, private schools, government, and New York City government agencies. With over $13.5 million of sales in 2020, they got 70 employees. They specialize in commercial roofing in the western half of Connecticut, the Lower Hudson Valley, and five boroughs of New York and Long Island. They do new roofing and also replace existing roofs. The breakdown varies from each year, but in 2020, they did 75% of sales from new construction and 25% was re-roofing. And they've got expertise in membrane roofing, metal roofing, custom sheet metal work, shingle, slate, and tile steep slope roofing, below grade waterproofing, plaza pavers, and an ornamental sheet metal work. I can't wait for Mills to tell me what all of that means. So they got 70 people, as they said. The roofing and sheet metal division, this is important, is 100% union. And they started a solar division in 2020, which is 100% non-union. The business landed a national account servicing approximately 200 stores, strip malls, and shopping centers in Buffalo, New York to Baltimore, Maryland. The solar division was started to be more competitive for that account. It seems like it's complementary with their roofing business, but solar panels on the roofs that they install. The solar business did $500,000 in sales with about 50%, 45% margins in 2020. So this national account they just signed, they're really excited about, has about 20 million square feet of roof. And their plan is to use their non-union solar division to put re-roof about 10 to 12% of that and put solar on there, sounds like. So they expect to triple 2020 sales in their solar division. They also just landed a $2.7 million private job in the solar division. It's weird because they kind of are mixing roofing with solar in the solar division. I think they're probably just trying to put work in that business because it's non-union, calling it the solar division when it also does roofing. So they basically say it's priced at $6.6 million, poised for large growth. They grew by 20% in 2020, and they say they're going to do that again in 2021. And they got a well-trained workforce, and the owner wants to retire. They've got 16,000 square feet out of which they run their operation. The seller's willing to stick around for a year or two and train you. Looks like they've got a director of operations in place and, you know, some other high-level people, director of biz dev, chief estimator, accounting, compliance officer, safety manager, you know, foreman in each of the states, et cetera. So it does seem like a relatively well-built out organization. So I don't know much about roofing, but I'm excited to learn. What do you guys know about roofing, or what piques your interest about this deal?
Yeah, I mean, so we've looked at quite a few different roofing organizations. What I would say is we put these in the category of building envelope. So building envelope being kind of everything that encloses a building in. And I think that they all kind of tie together. This is certainly what we call a subspecialty of the building envelope business. Other subspecialties would be maybe some, you know, wall structure, waterproofing would be one, foundation would be kind of another thing to think about. But this is definitely kind of in that category. You know, one of the things you got to be careful of with building envelope is they are probably the highest liability businesses. So one of the things I'd want to go back on this business and really dive into is what is the history of lawsuits or threatened lawsuits? And this is something that is incredibly prevalent in this industry. And so typically what happens is something leaks and they can't figure out where the leak is, or they can't figure out what caused the leak, and everyone gets sued. So the architect gets sued, the people who put the roof on get sued, the construction firm that built the walls get sued, the foundation people get sued, the waterproofing company gets sued, everyone gets sued. And then basically they negotiate and try to get, you know, chunks of flush from everyone. So insurance is incredibly high in this business and escalating quickly. So in terms of when I look at a business, maybe to take a step back, I always think about, you know, what are the things that could cause this business to look more attractive on the surface than it really is, or potentially what could cause this business to look less attractive than it really is? And I would say, you know, it sounds like a longtime owner who's run this thing for a long time in a certain way. So probably somebody else is not going to come in and run it better in the short term, would be my guess. This is a business that's heavily reliant upon people and systems. This is not a technology business by any means. And so probably there's not going to be a tremendous amount of upside on the improving of the actual roofing itself. And the person who you're bringing in to replace the CEO is probably not going to do a better job of actually running the business towards the core value that they offer. And so I would be concerned about the sort of the legal side. I'd be concerned about the how they do their WIP accounting. So WIP accounting is, you can make a construction business look as profitable as you want in any sort of given year, maybe even a 2-year period, depending on the length of the contract and length of the work. So I'd really want to dive into that. Obviously, union is it can be wonderful or it can be difficult. I think that it's easy sometimes to say that non-union businesses are better than union. I think they just have different pluses and minuses. I would say, you know, if given the choice, we'd probably go non-union. It just adds a layer of complexity. But we've seen some union businesses that are fantastic, and the union provides a really good value. I think it's like anything else. A union's not a union's not a union. Like they're very different how they operate and the value that they actually really add. Some are incredibly extractive and others are not. So, you know, I would say we'd want to really dive into that. Geography for both taxation and regulations, rough. Northeast is tax heavy and regulation heavy. And it's definitely difficult to run labor intensive businesses. I should say it's difficult to run labor intensive businesses everywhere. It's more difficult to run them in the Northeast. And so I'd also want to look into sort of what past labor issues have they had? Where are they getting access to labor? Obviously they're union, so they're coming up through the union shops. How are the union? Almost have to do a back diligence on the unions there and understand kind of what's the union pipeline for keeping talent full. What is the inflationary pressures from the union look like in terms of wages, and kind of, you know, what are the set aside requirements for union in those areas that really constitutes your, I guess, potential revenue base would be the way to look at it. Outside of that, I mean, the new stuff they're doing, to me, I put a zero on that. So everything new is difficult, even if it sounds promising. I don't think it's a negative and I don't think it's a positive. I think if they grow the way that they say they're going to grow, it's going to be brutally difficult. And they probably have the opportunity to lose a tremendous amount of money or make a bunch of money. So I think it could be good or it could be bad. I think it's going to be how and all it's managed. But that doesn't excite me too much. I mean, it just adds another layer of complexity, which makes the leadership transition that much more difficult. So if you look at what would be the real pivot point around this is what leadership really can step into place. Usually in these types of businesses with this size, there's not a bench of talent there that's really top notch. So what you typically find in these situations is an owner who's really great. I mean, obviously he built a business that's doing quite well, and he's done it for a long time. You know, to have somebody step into those shoes is difficult to start. To have somebody step into those shoes and manage a legacy business and manage basically a startup, completely new growth business is like unheard of. So my guess is one of those two is going to suffer and suffer pretty badly. And that's kind of why I zero it out as it, you know, could be great. But my guess is if we were interested, it's a little too small for us. But if we were interested, if let's say it was a bigger organization, we'd almost say to the owner, why don't you go run that other thing for 2 years while being in concert with us? And if it goes great, then we'll buy it from you, right? We'll sign a contract to buy it from you at sort of pre-agreed upon price. But we're going to buy the legacy business and let's work on transitioning that and set up incentives there. And then why don't you, you know, go do your thing over there and sprinkle the same magic on that new business that you have on your current business? Because we don't think that we're going to be capable within a short period of time to transition successfully the existing legacy business and basically create a startup that's bolted together.
Yeah. It's interesting whenever I see these kind of two businesses in one, somebody in a core business line and they're expanding into something, it's usually one of three things. Either A, the core business is terrible. And they need to, you know, move into a higher margin line of service or whatever it is, or B, shiny object syndrome, you know, on the part of the owner, which is very real and have fallen victim to, you know, myself a lot of times, or sometimes kind of growth has capped out in the core business and they need to go somewhere else to keep growing. Very rarely is it that, oh, there's just money lying on the floor and we're just going to start this whole other division to pick it up. The focus thing, as you said, Brent, would worry me here.
So it looks like this business runs at like 12% SDE. Is that kind of typical for a roofing contractor like this? Is that high, low, what you'd expect?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that's probably about what you'd expect for a business like this. Specialty construction, you're typically going to run between sort of 9, 10% on the low end, maybe up to 15%, depending on how well managed and sort of how margin works out. I mean, when you get larger, it typically levels out. You'll have some great projects that you have high margin on. You'll have a couple every year that you don't make a bunch of money on. When you're smaller like this, it's more volatile. So it wouldn't surprise me if you look at the history of this organization for it to go from, you know, almost a break even up to 2.5 million down to 1.2, you know, it's going to bounce around a lot, just based on the lack of anchoring with size.
And you mentioned that, you know, say for permanent, this is too small, right? You have your investment mandate, I'm sure, but it sounds like you were also talking about and maybe you drill in, what changes when, say, somebody gets to 25 or 30 million in revenue as an attractiveness of the level of business versus where this guy or this business is, right? It feels like you're talking about the bigger the business gets, the more stable it is. What other things kind of shift?
Yeah, well, I mean, so the way we think about this is basically every time you double in size, you're going to break all your systems. So you just got to prepare for that. And so a business that has doubled or tripled maybe from here is going to have to gone through that rebirth multiple times, which makes it a more durable organization. So they're going to typically take the best of what they'd had before, and then they're going to jettison the worst of it. They're going to rebuild their systems around sort of the new needs. They're going to demonstrate an ability to recruit and retain talent at a far higher level. And they're going to just sort of by necessity have a more robust leadership team and systems. And so the issue is just, do you want to spend the time and money and heartache to build those things, or do you want to buy them? And so that's why businesses that are smaller typically go for a lower price, is because if you want to grow them, which I think everyone does, I mean, there are the exceptions, but you know, I like to say small businesses don't say small on purpose. You know, you want to grow them. And so you're either going to have to go through the pain and suffering to help them grow and break all the systems through it, or you're going to be able to buy it. And so what I would say is I'd be worried from going from, sort of the cash flow that's here to double, I think would be a major transformation for this business, which for us, adding another $1.5 million to our, you know, sort of system-wide free cash flow just probably wouldn't be worth the pain and suffering that we'd have to go through to help them through that process. So that's why for us, it would be buying something that if they were doubled in size from there and they were at 3 million in cash flow, that'd kind of be on the lower end. We'd love to really see them more like 5 or 6 million in cash flow. And having gone through that sort of doubling twice, that would lead them to break all their systems again and again and come out hopefully a lot stronger.
There's another kind of part of risk that I smell here is kind of that key man owner risk. It seems like this guy has done a good job of hiring below him. At least it lists in the sim that they've got director of ops, they got, you know, foreman in all the states. I would worry sometimes a little bit though, especially in the Northeast where this business can be so, you know, the construction business is so union, it's so kind of who do you know, it's so relationship driven. You know, I would want to really understand, is this guy winning jobs because of who he is? He's been in the business forever, probably knows a ton of people, lives in the area, a lot of repeat clients. He said, I would really want to understand or make sure that if I buy this business, I don't come in on day one and all of my customers are not interested in buying roofs from me anymore because I'm some guy from out of town that's not the owner.
Yeah, Bill, I would definitely say that's definitely a concern. I would say it's less a concern in kind of the way, though, that you framed it. I don't think he's probably winning based on relationships. He's probably winning based on the ability to get things done and the reputation to get things done. So I don't think that probably it's like, oh, hey, you know, I really like Bob and Bob and I go play golf every week. And, you know, I know his kids, right? It's probably not that level of relationship where I think you can get into some other B2B type relationships that have that level of sort of personal connectivity. I think it's probably just more of a matter of like the union's trust that they're going to give them good work. It's worked for a long time. So you sort of got a client on the union side, right? Which makes this more complicated. And then you've got clients that are basically reputation based. I mean, at the end of the day, especially in the environment that we're in right now, if you can get good work done, no one cares. I mean, everyone's going to put up with a lot of garbage, to be honest. If you can just do good work, it's not going to come down to, did you play golf together or have dinner together or not? But I think that it is a valid concern to be concerned about the reputational risk that would come with a transition, especially depending on who bought this business. You know, like if it was, honestly, this is one that would be better for like an individual buyer, I think, to step in. Kind of similar how Mills has done it with his business, I think would be a really good example of that. And, you know, and slowly transitioning over time and sort of having that what we call trust transfer occur. Whereas versus like a firm that came in, I think there'd be a lot of skepticism if even a quote unquote small private equity firm came in to buy this thing.
Yep. Yep.
How do we feel about the, it looks like they're playing union games and like they're like when the union side gets busy, they're giving the solar business some of the stuff. That just feels weird to me. Or is that just normal that this type of stuff happens in specialty contracting?
It's a dangerous game. I mean, I would say it happens a decent amount. It's a game that we don't want to play. It's a game that's fraught with risk, kind of on both sides, and you end up, you know, alienating everyone. I would say that there's definitely risk there. I'd say the thing that's most risky, if they've been walking that tightrope for 2 decades, I'd be less concerned about it. They'd figured out a way to make it work, harmonize it. The fact that they are just getting that division off the ground and it's like you know, I can see where the thought process is. Okay, look, solar goes on roofs. We know roofs. We're on roofs all the time. Like, people know us as the roof people. Like, let's go and get into solar. Hey, we don't want to, you know, we have bottlenecks with our existing union. And it's hot, you know, it's more expensive, it's more costly. Hey, I got an idea. Why don't we go non-union? This will work out great. And by the way, projections are to the moon and rocket, 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 you know, that type of thing. If you haven't done something, it always appears to be far easier and more straightforward than it actually is. And so, the first question I would ask is, fantastic. This really, you know, excellent projections. I mean, if this goes great, you know, good work. When in the past have you done something like this? And, you know, they might say, oh, well, you know, we tried something 7 years ago and it typically didn't work out, but let me tell you why. And what you're going to find is typically a pattern of repeated failure outside the core business, or you're going to find that they have never really done anything outside the core business and they're setting themselves up for an expensive lesson.
They're listing the solar stuff as being attractive. Is that true? Like, do we think that like solar installations are really going to boom in the Northeast and Hudson Valley and stuff, or does that feel like a pipe dream?
I would say if a company had a deep expertise in solar and had some sort of durable competitive advantage, and you know, I'm not anti-solar. I just don't think that, you know, you saying, hey, one day we popped up our head and said, solar panels go on roofs and we know roofs, so we're going to get into the solar business. Like, that doesn't demonstrate to me any sort of sustainable competitive advantage. I think it, you know, at best, if you're going to use a financial term, they're going to be exposed to some beta of the solar market, but there's no sort of core expertise or core systems or technology that they've developed. We've looked at probably, I don't know, 80 to 100 solar businesses, and all of them that we found, I mean, maybe there was one or two in there that had a little something unusual, but most of them are just pure beta plays. They're commodity businesses. They're going to go up when there's government incentives and there's a lot of demand and sort of green field in that space, and then they're going to slow down or go under as soon as there's not. And they're pretty levered in terms of operating. So, you know, if they go down 20% in revenue, their profits are going to go down 80%, things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting market, because it seems like, at least on the, me being more of the marketing lead gen guy, on the lead gen side, all of these solar companies have popped up that are like sending people door to door. They're doing all this digital marketing. They're running TV ads, you know, put solar on your roofs. And I think the average consumer, you know, doesn't really see it. But to me, it smells like, oh, well, they're just going to then, you know, they're either asset light or they're going to hire an actual solar contractor to do the work. There's clearly some sort of government incentive here. They're going to securitize the loan they're going to offer you and sell that off. Yep. It's just the explosion of that has been nuts. I actually think we should do one of those businesses on the show later. Brent, I'm just curious, if you've looked at so many solar businesses, where is the value being extracted in the solar supply chain? Is it in on that side, the lead gen, and not so much on the installation side?
Well, I mean, I think that when you have a tremendous amount of government incentives and you're sort of distorting the natural demand in the marketplace, I mean, in essence, if you want to think about it, it's a government transfer between the government and people who want to get solar figured out, right? Whatever that mm-hmm. is, like, you know, wherever you are in the value chain, I think you can be extractive all the way down. I haven't seen so many solar companies that are durably profitable beyond like, hey, there's a bunch of demand because in this geography, maybe there's local, there's regional. The amount of layering of incentives for solar has been so crazy. I mean, there's some markets where you have like special like districts that are set up that have incentives. And then there's incentives that are layered on top of that citywide. And then beyond that, there are state incentives. And beyond that, there are federal incentives. So you're like quadruple dipping all the way down the chain there. And so when you look at stacking all those things together, it has an incredibly distortive effect on what actual demand is. I mean, I don't know how many people wake up on a daily basis and say, you know what I want to do is focus my life today on trying to figure out how I put solar panels on my house. Like, that just, it doesn't seem like something that is going to be like a big demand. Now, if you say, hey, look, like, it'd be nice if we could be, you know, if the government's going to pay for us to lower our electricity bill by 80%, that sounds pretty good, depending on how tight money is and depending on kind of how you think about the environmental impact, which I think is far less clear than maybe people expect it to be. But depending on how you look at those things, I think that's where you start getting incentives. If you pull all the incentives away, I doubt the solar industry looks the same. And so in essence, you're making a bet on, you know, kind of who's going to be in political power at varying different levels, depending on the incentive programs. You're making a bet on technology. And you know, I mean, one of the actual, probably the pluses of the solar business is if you get people to install what I'm going to call Gen 1 solar power, and Gen 2 comes out, and then you get to go and re-roof all those houses with Gen 2 solar power. And then you get, you know, Gen 3 that comes out that has to be like sort of magnitude order better. I mean, I think that that's actually a, you know, a bet you could make, that I'm not in a position to make that bet. But I think that's something that you could probably say is, hey, I've done my research on the solar business, and I think that it's going to follow sort of the same computing laws. And we're going to have an exponential over the next 20 years, exponential growth in the, you know, efficacy of solar panels as being a technology. And so we want to get into this business because basically we can create, triple or quadruple dipped customers over the next 15, 20 years and go back to the same ones over and over again and say, hey, by the way, we installed your, you know, solar panels on your house 2 owners ago, and this new gen has come out. If we just pop these things on, you're going to pay us 10 grand a day. But if we pop these things on the existing chassis that's on your roof, it's going to save you, you know, $15,000 over the next 3 years or something like that. I think that's actually a pretty powerful business model. It's kind of like one of the best business models I ever heard of is just slapping the stickers on the HVAC units at houses is like the highest returning investment you can make. And in fact, I heard about a business one time that their entire sales and marketing strategy was doing free in-home audits of the HVAC units. And what they would do is, it was very surreptitious, but they would actually take their stickers and slap them on top of the old stickers. So the owner never knew. Even if they didn't get the business, the owner would then call them back and they would even get the business later.
Yep. I had a guy out to fix my garage door, and they did the exact same thing. They slapped a sticker right there next to my opener with their phone number on it.
Yep.
And guess what? I called him back 2 years later. It worked.
It works.
Yep. All right. Let's maybe move on to our next deal. But first, Michael, will you do our sponsor read?
Yes. So this is a new sponsor for us. It is called More, and it's run by Greg and his team. And they are a business that helps people build Philippines-based teams. So basically, they are looking at how they can help U.S.-based businesses who have jobs that can be done remotely. And, you know, I think we're all familiar with how hard it is to hire right now in the U.S. And so what they do is you can not only hire basic, you know, virtual assistants, which I think a lot of people are familiar with in the Philippines, but also kind of business process outsourcing to folks that you have there. Actually, this morning I was talking to an entrepreneur. He only has 2 people in the U.S. and everybody else is in the Philippines, and you wouldn't even know it, you know. And he was talking about how he has started to not just hire kind of virtual assistants overseas, but people of higher caliber as well. So like marketing coordinators, biz dev, all of that is starting to get done. So Greg and his team are a first-time sponsor today, and business is morenow.co. So take a look at them. You know, they have different models where they work with folks. And then if you mention Acquisitions Anonymous as a new customer, you get 20% off your first hire. So they have offered that discount to our folks. So go to morenow.co or email hire@morenow.co to pursue that.
Yeah, I just want to add here, in my industry, in e-commerce, Filipino outsourcing especially is very popular. I know whole e-commerce businesses. My friend has an office in Cebu in the Philippines with 25 people. He has a lease. You know, he's built his whole business over there and just raves about the work ethic of the folks in the Philippines. It's something about their culture is just embedded, you know, great work ethic, you know, high integrity. You know, if you kind of sniff around as far as kind of like work cultures you'd like to hire into, Philippines, you know, continually kind of comes out towards the top. So for whatever reason, I hear of a lot of people outsourcing Philippines. Yeah. We have a couple there too, so you should try it.
Speaking of the Philippines, have you guys ever been to Jollibee? Are you familiar with this?
No, what is Jollibee? I've heard of this.
So you got to, if it will change your life. Jollibee is a Philippines-based fast food restaurant. And if you have a moment, go find the
Brent leans in immediately. Tell me more.
go find the Anthony Bourdain visit where he goes and sings the praises of Jollibee. And it is basically take everything that could be composed in an unhealthy manner and make it even unhealthier. And they have all of these just fascinating flavor combinations, like peanut butter spaghetti. Like, I'm just making, that may not be a real thing, but that's what it reminds me of, like jelly on hamburgers. Like, they do all this crazy stuff that together just turns into kind of this magical thing. And we have a Jollibee here in San Antonio, believe it or not. They've started to open these in the US. And if you're ever like visiting with a Filipino, like ask them about Jollibee. And like I was on a cruise once and the Filipino like steward was like, yeah, whenever I go ashore, I just buy 7 days worth of Jollibee and it's all I eat. Like, it's just a fascinating thing. So if you ever have a chance, watch the Anthony Bourdain video of Jollibee. It'll blow your mind.
And you will relate to your Filipino employees that much better.
Or as well. You could seem really out of touch. I don't know.
Maybe.
Either way, it's fine. Okay, so sorry for that digression. Deal number two.
All right. This is you, right, Michael?
Yeah, this is it. Cool. So this is one from Generational Equity, which is a brokerage that we've come to respect for, well, having some interesting stuff. So it's a business out of New England. It's a precision custom optical component manufacturer. The business size is $6.5 million, and they do $650K in EBITDA, and that looks like 2021 projection. They grew a little bit over 2020. They did $6.3 million in 2020 revenue and $450K in EBITDA in 2020. So the business is 6 decades old. It's based in New England, and it's headquartered there. It is a leading manufacturer and reliable supplier of custom precision optical components, servicing the semiconductor, biomedical, high-energy laser, aerospace, defense, and many more diversified industries. And the company offers state-of-the-art glass polishing, glass machining, optical assembly, and full metrology services on a variety of materials in different sizes. They sell to various industries in the U.S. and Canada, Europe, and they have an active base of over 100 customers, with 75% coming from repeat business. They claim that the customer base is stable and diverse and a key asset for the business going forward. Great reputation, high quality services, good employee team, yada, 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 typical stuff that you see in a sim. They use a variety of equipment such as surface grinders, vertical milling machines, CNC machines, interferometers, CO2 laser engraving, mechanical inspection equipment, and much more, in addition to designing and building their own custom machinery and tools to fulfill the needs of customers and reduce lead time. Business is about 80% US, 20% international, 75% customer retention rate. And most of their customers' top three categories are semiconductor, commercial, and high energy user. They claim to have some benefits here to owning this business, moats around brand name and reputation. It looks like they have a number of international certifications, ISO 2001, stuff like that. Like any teaser, they claim to have significant growth opportunities, international reach, and they have over $4 million worth of equipment and custom-built equipment to enable future expansion, expanding number of shifts and stuff like that. And the broker feels like they have high barriers to entry. Getting into this type of stuff would be difficult for somebody else to come in, especially considering this thing's been around for 60 years and the customer relationships that they have. Team-wise, they have 17 people working in what they call optical, 8 in production, 10 in quality control, 2 in maintenance, 7 in design, and 1 owner. So this looks like a hub and spoke management situation where the owner, I don't see a lot of layers of management here, but team-wise, that's 25, 35, looks like about 42 people. So that's it. So we have this precision custom optical component manufacturer, $6.5 million revenue, 10% profit, EBITDA margins. What do we think?
I hate this business.
Wow.
I hate this business. First of all, if after 6 decades, you're making $500,000, there's going to be some challenge that is at least one, if not two or three, that are going to be really abundantly obvious once you get to know the business. Major defects. I would say the return on assets is super concerning, right? $4 million of net assets is what they're claiming. They probably have a lot higher level of gross assets. They're probably using some form of leverage on their balance sheet, which means at best, their return on assets is around 10%. That's a really challenging position to be in. I mean, look, that's the gravity of any business is your return on assets. So if you're going to grow this business, there may be some operating leverage. I mean, the fact that they added $200,000 of revenue between 2020 and 2021, and added, they're claiming $200,000 of EBITDA, means that it's 100% operating leverage there, which I would strongly, I'd be shocked if actually held under scrutiny. But just the, even at, you know, $650,000 of EBITDA on $4 million of assets, I mean, let's talk about the actual sort of post-close or post-tax, post-reinvestment return, assuming there's not a huge working capital change, is like probably 3 or 4% to the owner. So, you know, every time you want to grow this business, if you want to add another, you know, if you want to say double in size, in order to add another $500,000 of revenue, you're going to have to, you know, add sort of $5 million of capital to the business in one form or another. I mean, that's just the makings of a terrible business.
And God help you if you got to replace your $4 million of machines.
Right. Well, that's what my question would be is, I mean, you know, if you got $4 million of assets, unless you're gearing up for something major that hasn't hit yet, I mean, it's not obvious from this that that's the case. I mean, this is actually a business that might actually not make money. And may have been popping along for six decades without not making much money because I think the owners probably got into this weird, like, it's too big and too important not, you know, to shut it down. But it's also like it doesn't really do anything. So you just get stuck in the treadmill. So I would be very skeptical. I don't understand also actually what they do based on the description here. So I would have to get, you know, much more deeply into the actual, like where they are in the value chain and who's going to them for what services. Cause it seems like, I mean, this is always the catch 22 of a SIM is some SIMs say we do everything. It's like, well, great. You do everything. That means you do nothing. Right. It looks like it's such a wide, you know, amount of things. I mean, they're doing glass polishing, but they're also doing optical assemblies. Like I don't know how, you know, those things kind of fit together. And so what I would say is, it could be one of these sort of commodity relationship type businesses. Bill, on the last one that we talked about, you said, hey, I'm concerned about the relationships. This is actually one where I'm actually concerned about the relationships. Because if you're doing a lot of different things and they seem to be kind of disconnected or only loosely connected, what that typically means is you have a really good relationship with a couple people and they say, hey, can you do this thing for us? And they say, sure, yeah, we'll do that thing. And so over time, over six decades, you sort of add to a hodgepodge of things. And what that ends up doing is, you end up being mediocre at everything, and there's really no expertise there to scale. So again, I would drop this thing in a heartbeat. I probably wouldn't pursue it just based on kind of what I read there and the return, you know, estimates. But I'm happy to hear you guys if you disagree.
I don't like the return on assets either. The thing that if I wanted to find reasons to like this, right, you could charitably look at this and say, okay, they got 75% repeat customers. Is it possible you've got, you know, they make some special thing and maybe it's a little niche-y and maybe nobody else is interested in doing it. So, you know, you have to get really comfortable about the quality of those assets and make sure that you didn't need a ton of CapEx to keep your little annuity going. But is it maybe possible they've got some sort of niche here? It's never going to be huge. But they've got repeat customers forever. Maybe. I don't know. What's also kind of jumped off the page at me that was interesting is on the list of certifications, they have this one called International Traffic in Arms Registered, which I had not seen before. And I Googled it and it's for export of firearms and military equipment. So now I just want the book to see what it is, right? So I don't know. You know, they didn't mention that government was a huge end market for them, but I wonder if this 20% of revenue is coming from exporting some sort of rifle scope or some sort of optical something. So there's maybe some interesting stuff there. I also look at, you know, certifications like that are probably not very easy to get at all. You know, and then I sort of wonder, A, is it transferable? But if it is, can you leverage that to export other things or sell, you know, maybe that's the moat. You could leverage that certification as a moat if you wanted to get psyched about this business for some reason. You know, those are kind of the things that jump off the page for me.
Yeah, I totally agree as is. It looks like a big turd. I think the interesting thesis that I had when I first read it was, you know, and showing it, I showed it to Reg Zeller, who's rolling up non-ferrous foundries, which we may agree or disagree is a good business or a bad business. The way he talks about it seems like a good business. And it felt like there were some parallels to what he's doing there. And I showed this to him and it was interesting because I think the only way this deal gets interesting at all is if you go in with a thesis that it's underperforming significantly. And Reg talked about their output per employee seems very low. It smells like they're probably pricing poorly and taking on, Brent, like you're talking about, some business that might not even be good at all. So, you know, I saw this and kind of liked it from the perspective of, okay, it sucks as is, but like, is there some unlockable value here in terms of being able to go in, like start pricing stuff the right way? I mean, one of the things Reg does when he rolls up these non-ferrous foundries, like he goes in and like they do like a you know, per customer P&L, like should we keep doing this, harmonize prices and stuff like that. And especially, you know, with a business 60 years old, you got to imagine there's some non-profitable customers in here. Totally. So I see this more as a like value add from a real estate perspective. So I think that's the one reason to get excited about it. Could you take that $4 million in equipment costs that they have sunk in and turn this into $1.5 million to $2 million like profitable business? I don't know. That's I think the one way to look at it.
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, maybe we could talk about the 6-decade thing. I mean, I said after 6 decades, if you're, you know, if you're at this size, that means there's just sort of major deficiencies. But after 6 decades, if you're still in business, period, it means there's typically something there. So what I would say is, you know, if I were the, you know, son or daughter or nephew of this business owner and was like gifted this business, I'm sure there's something to work there on. I think the question is for any acquirer, of all the places you could spend your time and attention and of all the uses of your expertise, is this the place that you really want to like rescue and go deep in? And getting involved in, you know, a quagmire. Which this thing looks like to be a quagmire, you know, you could lose 10 years of your life pretty quickly in something like this. So I think that's, you know, I would not be, I mean, look, it's clearly making money and it's making good living for the owner and kudos to them. I don't want to be derogatory about that at all. And, you know, it sounds like it's probably a second generation or third generation business. I would just say as an acquirer, I'm not sure that's the hill I want to die on.
Yeah.
Yeah. This falls in the category of businesses where you're like, as you kind of said, man, if I got this for free, maybe. Right. But there's just, it doesn't underwrite. Like there's no way for you to buy this business for any meaningful amount of money. And you just know that, you know, at least half or all those $4 million of assets need to be refreshed over the next 5 years. Also.
Well, and let's just talk about price here for a second. Right. Because we got to talk about price, right? I mean, are you really going to sell your $4 million of assets at a discount? I mean, how much of a discount? So if the business is making, let's call it really normalized earnings of $200,000 or $300,000, which is what it sounds like maybe at best we could expect from something like this, are you really going to pay 20 times for this business? Right? What are you going to pay? Are you going to pay four times that? You're going to pay $700,000 or $800,000 for a business with $4 million of assets? I mean, the only way that you make money potentially in this business over the long term is you buy it for, you know, $500,000, $800,000, and then you go and liquidate all the assets, right? I mean, basically, that's just a liquidation shop. I mean, I don't think that's something that a normal acquirer wants to buy and grow something. So I think that's where it's just these businesses get in these weird cycles where, the momentum takes them. They need to reinvest in order to stay in business. There's never really enough cash, and I have no idea what the debt on this business looks like. I'd imagine they're using, you know, debt of some type to be able to buy those assets. So again, it's a quagmire.
Yeah, totally hear you. Yeah. Well, I do think it, you know, I've been talking on this thing, I call it the Girdley thesis, is that the only deals we're going to be doing in this cycle of the market are ones that at first glance look like total crap. And you could go, because, you know, like we did a deal this year and it's like everybody passed on it because it looked terrible. But like once you kind of got underneath the hood, like it was really good. So it does pass at least the first part of the Girdley test. The problem is a lot of times the second half of the Girdley test is, yes, when it looks like crap, it is actually crap. So this may be one of those.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, you make a good point, Michael. I mean, and that's, I hope what people are getting out of this podcast a little bit is how to look for what the gems that might be hiding under the surface. Because in this market, it used to be that you could go into private equity and you could create alpha just by being disciplined, right? And only buying good businesses. Because lots of people just bought any business that came across their desk, you know, or weren't as smart as you, right? So you could just create alpha by being a good chooser of businesses. Now, the good businesses go for crazy prices, you know, in this, maybe it's cyclical, you know, maybe it's maturity level of private equity, I don't know. But these days, it's pretty hard to get a good price on a good business. So at least, you know, my experience is these days, you've got to develop a differentiated thesis on an asset, something that's got some hair on it, and you think you've got the right razor to shave the hair off of it. So when I see stuff like this, I find myself looking at a lot of things that I go, yeah, this is probably terrible, but there is maybe a 10% chance, you know, there's something here. And if there is, that's where the alpha is, right? But then you got to be smart enough to walk away from 98% of them, I guess.
Really true. I'll be curious to see what this business, if it transacts at all, right? I think, Brent, you make a really good point and what it would trade for. You know, you may have an owner that just looks up and says like, oh, I think my equipment's worth $4 million and you're only going to give me 2x pro forma EBITDA for this thing, or, you know, the best offers they get look like that, you know, then what do they do? I don't know.
Yep. These sale processes kind of end in stalemate a lot. I do not envy the broker who's got a seller that says, I want $10 million for this business. It's my life's work. And the buyers that go, I'll take it for free.
Or how much are you going to pay me to take this off your hands?
Right.
Even worse.
Right. I do wonder what happens to all these businesses, because there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah. I don't know. You find a cousin or something willing to come in and got nothing better to do? Go down to the bus station, find somebody? I got me.
Yeah. I don't know. Or desperate searcher, right?
I've seen some of those recently.
Yep. All right. I guess we can wrap it up. Michael, you want to play us out?
Yeah. Thanks again to our two sponsors today. So Greg Carey and his team at morenow.co, build your team overseas in the Philippines. And then Charlie Perrin's cloudbookkeeping.com. So for your outsourcing your bookkeeping services, especially around QuickBooks for your small business. So Brent, one of the things, you know, we really want to do, and you've done a great job today, talking a bunch, and it was fantastic. You know, we have a pretty steady and good loyal audience for the podcast. What can we as a host or as an audience do to support you? What would be the best thing that comes to mind?
I hadn't seen Mills's beard in a long time. So I would just ask that maybe we could have a naming campaign for Mills's beard. It looks like it should have its own name at this point. And so maybe we could, as a community, come together, put forth some names that would be honoring of the, assuming it seems like the small furry animal that has attached itself to Mills's face, and really just give some encouragement to it. So that would be my ask of the community.
That's amazing.
Reply to us on Twitter when we release this episode in the thread with names, proposed names for Mills's beard.
Yeah. And if, you know, and one of the things I'll say about Brent, you know, this is our second time getting on a call together. There are people that are great and super nice people on Twitter and social media, and then you talk to them and they're jerks. And then there are people that are jerks on social media and great vice versa. Brent is one of the special people that is just a wonderful, loving, nice human being and a pleasure to be around in both. So definitely recommend his social media and Twitter. It's an inspiration for me, and I know Bill as well. So definitely check him out there and follow their business, Permanent Equity. Lots of cool stuff going on.
Absolutely. Thanks for
having me on, guys.
Awesome. Appreciate to have you, man. It.